Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. Coming up on the program this week, there are so many financial questions that may be running through your head when it comes to retirement. Personal finance writer David Ashton wrote a book to help you answer those specific questions. It's called The Sleep Easy Retirement Guide, Answers to the 12 Biggest Financial Questions That Keep You Up at Night. And he'll be here to take us through it. Behavioral finance expert Daniel Crosby is here to talk about his 10 Commandments for Investors. It's an interesting twist on the actual Ten Commandments, and there's some helpful stuff in there. Then a new report from the C.D. Howe Institute on longer-term mortgages. We'll talk about why that case can be made. Plus, personal finance educator and author Kelly Keene will be here to talk about her latest book, Talk Money to Me. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by EQ Bank, Banking Simplified. Let's get started. Not many people, at least people that I know, like talking about money. It can be hard to understand. It can lead to stress. It can lead to relationship strife. Kelly Keene is going right after this deeply held consumer insight with her latest book. It is called Talk Money to Me. Save well, spend some, and feel good about your money. Kelly's an author, personal finance educator, and all-around great human. Hello there.
Oh, hello, my friend.
I know.
You love talking about money.
I do, too.
I love talking about money.
Why isn't everyone like us?
I don't know.
I mean, everybody should be like us. Their lives would be so much better if they just did exactly what we said at all times.
Well, you know what? I remember seeing you on stage a number of times, and I loved your, like, what is money for?
Yeah.
And I think if, you know, people like yourself start to make it fun, and that's what the aim is of this book, that it's not the finger wagging.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll talk about money more. So I love being on shows like yours, because that's what we want.
Well, there is so much great stuff in this book, but I first want to answer focus on this fundamental question, and that is, how do we get people to talk about it? Because you and I can talk tips and tactics and strategies.
Yeah.
We can talk about information. We can do all that, and it will make no difference if people don't open their mouths to their spouses, to their parents, to their kids, to their advisors, to all the people who will make a big difference.
Here's a couple of issues. I think, and the book is interesting, the title is Talk Money to Me, because when people have money, the conversation is much easier. Like, it's RSP season. Should I go into a TFSA or an RSP?
Right.
That we can talk about. There's still some issues because people feel embarrassment and shame that they don't know more.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll put that aside for a second. But when it comes to the lack of money, that's where people are not talking about it. Or, again, the embarrassment, the shame that comes with debt. We know that. I've been on your show before talking about how saddled Canadians are with debt. Your listeners know this. I think, Bruce, it's like we're back in the 1960s where, we used to whisper the word cancer.
Right.
Today we run for the cure. You would never, ever make someone feel shameful about having cancer. We've got Facebook support groups for them. But when it comes to a lack of money, which causes so many other issues, like you said, relationship stress, mental health issues, physical issues. People suffer in silence, and then they don't know who to reach out to. They're not seeing someone like a certified financial planner, a nonprofit credit counselor. They're thinking they're just going to try to solve it on their own. And you can.
Mm-hmm.
You can call up your credit card company and ask for a better rate. You can talk to your banker. But the reality is, when people are suffering with crippling debt, they don't know what's happening. They're scared. It's very unlikely they're going to have the confidence to negotiate on their own behalf.
Yeah. You write about some very clear topics, and in a different way. I mean, I talk about this stuff all the time. One of the chapters is called Leaving Money on the Table, which I love, because it kind of feels like, wow, if I just, I don't have to earn more or spend less, I just have to not leave it on the table.
Right.
Give us some of the examples that you talk about in that chapter that people could take action on.
There's so much. Yeah, exactly. And this is where a pro, as you were saying, can help you see those blind spots. So number one, women and men, by not negotiating their salaries, and especially their starting salaries.
You say women and men, but really we mean women.
Mostly women.
Mostly women, because they're not as assertive about it for a whole bunch of reasons.
Yes.
We've seen this in the data. So yes, we'll be equitable to say women and men, but really it's a call to action for women who aren't getting what they deserve.
Yeah, there's this great book called Women Don't Ask. It's a U.S. West book, and I love this book, and the author surmised that men and women, by not negotiating their starting salary, by the time they hit age 60, stand to lose $500,000. Women are obviously much more likely to not negotiate. They stand to lose, on average, $1 million.
Wow.
Now, what kind of retirement could you have if you had $1 million yeah. more flow into your life? That's one way that Canadians are leaving money on the table. Number two is not... like digging into your pension plan, your RSP matching, stock options. It's estimated that $3 to $4 billion is being left on the table every year by Canadians not taking like this free money.
Right.
Again, it's RSP season. So maybe some of your listeners are like, well, you know, they're earning a decent amount, but they have no money. So they're not going to go and see an advisor or a financial planner or something of that sort. But maybe if they did go and see that pro, this is totally hypothetical. I'm not providing any advice here. But maybe it might be something like, hey, if you did an RSP loan, you've got this room you haven't used,
yep.
you're going to get this nice juicy tax deduction because you're in a decent income bracket, and then yep. you can use that to pay down on your debt or yep. something like that. Yeah. I'm just making this up. It's unlikely you're going to come to this conclusion on your own and just be like, well, I don't have any money. No one yeah. wants to talk to me. You know,
yeah.
I'm not going to
yeah,
go
yeah,
and do
yeah,
that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, it's, yeah, there's so many ways we're leaving money on the table.
Did, like the way people engage with the company match on, yeah. you know, retirement savings and all that kind of stuff. I want to, the second topic that is particularly resonant to me is the car traps. You
right.
put this great story of Dave and Melissa. I loved how you painted this picture of them showing up at the dealership with their hungry twins.
Right.
It's like, okay, as a parent, never do that.
Uh-huh.
Terrible idea. They leave with two SUVs mm. and a massive amount of debt. Now, a part of one of the many lessons is you say, don't take the water and the pretzels. What do you mean by that? I think it's fantastic.
The reciprocity rule.
Yeah.
We never think of this. This is deeply ingrained. It's an evolutionary kind of like, it's to make sure, like, first of all, we lived in tribes, right? And we relied on tribes. So if I had some extra meat and I didn't need it all, you got some, but then you wouldn't pick some berries for me. And
right.
so we shared, right? So
right.
when I gave something, it's hardwired in our brain to want to give that back. So we think something so simple as, you know, you're thirsty on a hot day and the salesperson offers you a water, the kids are hungry and they've got some nice pretzels for you, that small act is enough to make you feel, you know, that you owe the salesperson something.
$120,000
right?
in SUVs.
Leave. And then they felt so relieved because the salesperson answered, did all the research for them in the first hour, right?
Yeah.
So it's all these little things that I want readers to be aware of that we don't realize direct our budget. Buying decisions.
The other tip you had for the dealership is go at the end of the day, at the end of the week, at the end of the month.
Yeah.
So they're in quota time.
Exactly. They're tired too. So if you know that people suffer from decision fatigue, that means we're making a million decisions throughout the day. And then we usually go at the end of the day to see the financial planner, see our banker, go car shopping. But if you were replenished, you took the Friday off and then went at the end of the day when that salesperson is tired, they
ooh,
want
that's
us,
good.
Right? They want the sale. They want that, you know, end of the month totals that their boss, you know, regardless if they had a good or a bad month. So flip the switch of what we're doing that's a mistake and then turn it on.
I almost
others.
Think you could find out their home phone number and call them a couple times in the middle of the night just to wake them up
that's
so that they'd
brilliant.
Be incrementally
so then
more
all
exhausted.
Tired, then
yes.
like you can really use your negotiating
you
prowess.
Also write eloquently about the sandwich generation, which is a huge, yeah. huge issue for people today. The point in particular that I want you to talk more about is understanding the value of time. What do you mean by that? And how does that relate to that?
And this is so counterintuitive to a book that you might think is talking all about saving money, making more money, things of that sort. I think probably because I went through it myself with my husband and looking after his mom, things of that sort. This is a reality for a lot of Canadians, is if you're not already in the sandwich generation. Where
it's coming.
It is coming.
In fact, it's good news if it's coming because otherwise your parents aren't with you
isn't
anymore.
That the
so,
truth?
So that's an empowered view right. of it's coming.
And it might be your parents. It might be your spouse's parents. I've had to help out with my mom, not financially, but it took my time. It meant lost time from work. So this is where I want readers to really understand, what are you making per hour? I want them to do a time audit, which sounds odd, but I want you to really look at you and your family. What are all the things that you do? And then is that realistic that you should still be doing those things based on what you earn per hour? And even if all things were equal, but you hate that thing, the snow removal, the lawn care, the cleaning of the house, whatever it is, the grocery shopping, is it better for you to actually, yes, spend money, the $11.99 to have your groceries delivered so you actually are less exhausted and enjoy your life more, especially when it comes to helping out parents? I think that's the only way to get through when they're not well and you need to be helping them, is to look at where does it make sense financially to hire things out that aren't exorbitant, right?
The book is Talk Money to Me. Kelly, I wish we had the entire day to talk. But at least we got a little bit of a snippet. Kelly Keene, the author of Talk Money to Me. Save well, spend some, and feel good about your money.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Retirement planning can easily keep you up at night. You might have like tons of questions swirling through your mind just as your head hits the pillow. For instance, how much do I need to save? How long do I need to work? Personal finance writer David Ashton wrote a book that will address many, if not all, of these questions. It's called The Sleep Easy Retirement Guide, Answers to the 12 Biggest Financial Questions That Keep You Up at Night. He's here now to take us through some of the questions and, more importantly, the answers. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
Now, how did you come up with these 12?
Well, I kind of in the process of thinking through my own retirement, these were the kind of questions that I had to think through for myself. So it's kind of like these were things that were kind of floating around in my mind,
right,
and I was turning them over in my mind. And as part of my journalism, I was researching the answers. So this was a process that I went through for myself.
And you've been writing for Money Sense for a very long time.
I have, yes.
And so I'm sure people like corner you at dinner parties and want to ask you all these questions. So now it's very efficient. You go, I'm not answering your question. Read my book. Go buy my book. I'm going to go through a couple. We don't have time to go through them all. But the question of the nest egg is very, very... It's controversial because there's so many methods, and it is so based on the assumptions you make on how much you spend.
True.
The math is very simple.
True.
How do you determine what that retirement income needs to be? Because it all boils down to that. If you want to have $1 million a year, what your nest egg needs to be very different than if you need $30,000 a year.
That's right. So these are all variables, if you will, in planning. So, you know, some people have the idea that, you know, they need, you know, thousands of dollars a year, and they're going to keep working till they get enough to give them X thousand dollars a year. But it's actually, you know, it's a very adjustable thing. It's if you have lots of money, you can plan for a nicer retirement. You can plan to spend more per year. You can maybe retire earlier. If you don't have quite as much money, maybe you need to economize a little bit more. Still, you should still be able to achieve your retirement dreams, but just a little bit more on a budget. Mm. And maybe you can't retire quite as early. So it's a way of, you know, basically you kind of adjust your goals with what your means are.
We're talking more about this particular aspect more than we were even a decade ago, and that is your question about how do I ensure I get good care late in life if I need it? That is the reality. So sure, the actuarial tables are saying we're going to live longer, but it doesn't necessarily mean we're going to live longer fully functioning physically and mentally in our home.
True.
So how do you work through those assumptions so you've got that backstop should you need it?
Well, that's a good point. That's a big uncertainty in terms of a financial issue that could come up late in life. In some situations, I mean, you know, you could end up dying very, very suddenly, and then, you know, there isn't an issue of having care. In other cases, you might need care at a high level for a long period of time.
Yeah.
So it is a complicated issue. One of the things that, you know, definitely helps, this is one of the areas where having equity in a paid-for home comes in really handy. So, you know, normally you don't factor in the equity in your home and in figuring out, you know, as part of your nest egg and figuring out your retirement. But it kind of helps in terms of having a backup plan.
Yeah.
If you have high care costs late in life, or you run short of money late in life. And then you can tap the equity in your home to help out. So often it comes in the form, if you have to move into a retirement home or a long-term care facility, that's often a good time to sell your home. You realize some of the equity, it can help pay for the cost of
And hope your spouse is on the same page. Because, it's a hard dynamic when one is fully functioning and engaged in the world and the other needs full-on dementia care.
And it's not always an easy or simple solution. As you point out, it could be a situation where one spouse is healthy and wants to stay in the home, the other needs long-term care. So there are complicated situations. Mm. It does at least help that the government has your back to a certain extent, because the long-term care facilities are set up in Canada so that they really are available to everybody. So
if you can get a spot.
Yeah, there's problems with it, the rest of the healthcare system, in terms of, and there's backlogs and things to get into it.
But yeah.
And there's a copay involved. It's a joint shared financial facility. But the idea is they don't turn anybody away for financial.
Another question is, how can I save my retirement if my finances get off track? And listen, there is illness, there is divorce, there is job loss. There's a lot of things. So what are some of the tips that you talk about in that chapter to course correct?
Well, I mean, one of the things that it's nice to have as part of your financial planning, it's nice to have a backup plan. So that's the idea that and it may be several things. For many people, it's just the equity in their house. So it's something that they can turn to if the rest of their plan kind of falls short. And then, if they never need the equity in your house, well, then that's just something you get to enjoy forever. And when you pass on, you pass on the equity and to your kids. So that's one thing. The other thing is to look at all aspects of the plan. If things start to, if the assumptions don't start to pan out and things get stressed. One of the things is that we often make assumptions about how much we're going to spend in retirement, which maybe they might be appropriate if everything's working out. But often if we really set our mind to it, we can achieve our retirement dreams with less income if we're creative and flexible and really kind of start to think through carefully just what our budget is and what our priorities are.
One of the other things that we're starting to see culturally is the generational differences about expectations. Yes. So a baby boomer lived in a world in which they could work for their career, retire at 55, 60, and then literally not work at all until the time they passed. I'm a Gen Xer, not an expectation my generation has. We think we will work in some capacity, either because we have to or because we want to, well into our 70s and maybe even 80s. How do you factor that into people's thinking, knowing that there are very different expectations? And I know I say generational, it's not exclusively generational, but it's certainly more common for a Gen Xer to have that outlook than it would be for a baby boomer.
Well, I think it's a good idea to keep an open mind when you're a long ways from retirement about what you're going to want to do when you're in your 60s and early 70s. I think it helps when you're planning early not to be too, make some heroic assumption that you're going to work at a really high-paying job until you're like 75.
Canada's only 85-year-old roofer.
So it makes sense not to count on that early on. But I mean, the fact of the matter is, like the whole world of work is really opening up for people in their 60s and even in their early 70s. And there's a lot more options there than there were in the past. And what the right option is for you is, really depends on your situation. There's lots of people that, have loads of money and they could afford to retire at some early age but they like what they're doing and it's they like being engaged socially and getting some money too. And so, they keep working because they want to keep working. So, and other people, necessity is more of a driver. So it's all about finding the right combination of money and fulfillment and engagement.
David, thank you very much for this and congrats on your book.
Thanks, Bruce. Thanks for having me on your program.
David Ashton is the author of The Sleep Easy Retirement Guide, Answers to the 12 Biggest Financial Questions That Keep You Up at Night. Moolah La, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by EQ Bank. EQ Bank provides state-of-the-art digital banking services and is the digital banking platform launched in 2016 by Equitable Bank, which has been around for decades. Their biggest product, their big product, is the EQ Bank Savings Plus account. It is a savings account with the flexibility of a checking account. So it's got unlimited transactions. There's no everyday banking fees, no minimum balances. It is fast. It is cheap. It is fully transparent on international money transfers. And all of that is from one account. The big deal, though, the thing that everybody's talking about, is that it pays an everyday interest rate of 2.45%. So it's got an everyday interest rate of 2.5%. And, you know, you think about, what does a GIC earn these days? Not a lot. That's what. EQ Bank, thank you for your support of this show. Coming up next on Moolah La, behavioral finance expert Daniel Crosby is here to talk about the 10 commandments of investor behavior. Then later, the founder of Directions Coaching, Ann Taylor, will be here to talk about her latest book, Soft Skills, Hard Results, a practical guide to people skills for analytical leaders. And you're thinking, what does that have to do with money? Stick around, I'll tell you. Can't get enough of Moolah La? Then you can head on over to the various podcast platforms out there, and you can actually subscribe to the podcast version of the show, so it just shows up on your device. You can also go to Moolah La and search for particular topics that are of most relevance to you. Don't forget, you can sign up too for the Moolah La newsletter, and it brings together all sorts of content that I do for CBC Radio, for Cityline, for Yahoo Finance, for the financial advisors podcast I host called Prosper. The newsletter comes once a month, and I will never do anything with your email address. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
If I had been paying better attention in Sunday school, I would have the real Ten Commandments down pat. I know stealing's a big no-no. I'm sure there's other, you know, I'm not supposed to covet things, etc. Well, we're going to take that idea of the Ten Commandments and relate them to investing, to investor behavior in particular. Daniel Crosby is a behavioral finance expert. He has his Ten Commandments on investing, and he joins us now from Atlanta, Georgia. Hello there.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
With all due respect to those people who are of faith and who follow the actual commandments, we do this as a helpful way to provide some value to our listeners as they relate to investing. And I want to start off with commandment number one. We won't have time to talk about all of them, but in commandment number one, in all markets, up, down, and sideways, you control what matters most. What are you getting at there?
Well, when I get asked about capital markets, which happens, you know, every week, people usually want to know, what's the Fed going to do? Always these externalities. And that's wrongheaded, because all of the research shows that you and I are the best predictors of whether or not we reach our financial goals. So there will always be wars. There will always be sickness. There will always be scary headlines. If we want to take control of our financial lives, we need to control the controllable, and nothing is more controllable than our human behavior.
Right. And so does that manifest specifically in what we spend, what we save, how we invest, those kinds of things?
Yeah, it's all of those things. It's these really sort of unglamorous little things, like automating your investment decisions, automating your withdrawal, having a budget, making your setting aside a little each month, just these little sort of unextraordinary things that everyone knows to do. Our ability to do those things with consistency is the absolute number one predictor of whether or not we cross that finish line.
Third commandment's pretty liberating. Start now, start again tomorrow, and start again the next day. Are you trying to get at the view that some people maintain it's just too late?
Well, yeah, that is exactly the thing. You know, people will say, oh, I wish I had started, you know, yesterday. So, you know, there's this saying that the best time to plant a tree was 100 years ago. The next best time is today, right? And the same is true of our investing and saving habits. There's two reasons why this beginner's mentality, this start again today mentality is so powerful. One, of course, is just mathematical. You know, money makes money. Mm. The power of compounding is extraordinary. So there's a mathematical reason why it makes sense. But there's also a psychological reason, which is it becomes habitual. The things that we start doing, we tend to pat ourselves on the back for the things that we're doing. We tend to be very self-congratulatory. And so if we can get a good habit rolling, an object in motion tends to stay in motion and an object at rest tends to stay at rest. And so there's a mathematical reason and a psychological reason why just getting started today and beginning that thing all over again tomorrow is a very powerful thing to do.
Number five is the most contrarian, I think, and that is the commandment that says do less than you think you should. Does that relate to like how many dishes I should be washing and laundry I should be doing?
Unfortunately, it is unique to investing because anywhere else in life, doing more gets you more. You know, doing more dishes gets you more points with your spouse. Mm. Doing more reps at the gym gets you bigger muscles. You know, reading more books gets you smarter. But we find that in every single country we have ever looked at, being more active in the market gets you lower returns. So this has been studied in 19 different countries. Everywhere we look, the more trades you make, the more you log into your account, the more you tinker and meddle with your investment account, the worse you tend to do. So Winnie the Pooh said, never underestimate the power of doing nothing. And that's a powerful advice for investors.
Words from Winnie the Pooh. Okay, number seven, if you're excited about an investment, it's probably a bad idea. I'm scandalized to hear you say that. I mean, obviously, I was around in the dot-com boom and bust. So I think that was an accurate characterization of, you know, pets.com and cooking.com. But does that still relate to big investment ideas that are people are excited about now?
It still does. And without mentioning anything in particular at
Bitcoin, cannabis.
Okay, there you go.
Yep.
For me, I think if you look at the things that people have been excited about in the recent past, they are now in the tank, right? They're now in the toilet because these things tend to signal market tops. And so we need to understand that the truest words in investing are this too shall pass. So in March of 2009, when the world seemed hopeless and it seemed like we'd never see another green day in the market again, that was a great time to be buying. And at times when there's intense mania, everyone's talking about an investment or a speculative asset class at around the table at dinner. Maybe that's the time to put on the brakes a little bit. So being excited is actually a contrary indicator, and good investing is actually quite painfully boring, I'm sad to say.
You said Green Day. Are you telling me the band, are they like day traders? Is that, did I, no.
I'm referring,
you
I'm,
meant
I'm
like the Rolling
the
Stones? Oh, the color of your stock portfolio. I thought this was like a Taylor Swift reference or something like that. Okay, number nine is like this incomprehensible koan, as I read it. You should be the benchmark. Like, does Yoda say this or the Karate Kid guy? What does that even mean?
Well, my name is Daniel. So
that is Daniel's son. Wax on, wax off. You be the benchmark. What does it mean?
Yeah, so this is a very Zen commandment. So this comes from this idea that we should be naming our dollars and personalizing our investment decisions. So what we found is that people tend to spend, save, and invest their money according to how they have earmarked it. And so if you look from 07 to 11 in the U.S., people were pulling money out of every possible stock investment they could, except for those funds that were earmarked as college funds. If it was earmarked as, you know, saving for juniors' education, people were able to stay the course. People were able to keep their heads about them because they had a yes that was bigger than the no of their fear. And so labeling your various accounts for something that you hold dear, something that you are passionate about, or even something that you value from sort of a moral or ethical standpoint, has been shown to increase and improve investor behavior. So make it personal. This isn't a video game. These aren't dots on a screen. This is your financial life, and you should think about it in the terms of what it's to be used for.
Okay, so this last one is either a total cop-out or the best one yet. Commandment number 10 is take this process and tailor it to your needs. Now, can you imagine if you said that to people of faith? Like, don't worry about commandment number 4, remember the Sabbath. It's fine. Oh, honor your father and mother. No, don't worry about that. So you're saying this is the last, like, easy out here. Tailor it to your custom circumstances? What?
Yeah, so this is I think a nod to getting a coach or an advisor, because the research shows that people who work with a professional tend to do better than those who don't, and partially because every circumstance is unique. And the research shows that it's not because these professionals are necessarily better at picking stocks or they're going to put you in an especially high-flying portfolio, but what they're going to do is they're going to keep you out of your own way. So research out of your home spot there in Canada showed that people who had worked with an advisor for the long term, so more than 15 years, had 2.7x the wealth of those who had been trying to go it alone. So whatever form that takes, I think people are wise to get guidance that will help them tailor the specifics of their financial needs to their specific situation. So it's, you know, perhaps a bit of a cop out, but it's one that's
all right. I didn't write it. You wrote it. I appreciate your time, Daniel. I think it's a great way to think about investing. Daniel Crosby, the 10 commandments of investor behavior. He joined us from Atlanta, Georgia. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up on Moolala, Michael Feldman is a partner at Torrey's LLP, and he's going to talk about this report that has quite possibly the worst name of any report later. So here's the title, and then I'm going to give you my new fancy version. It's called One More Case for Longer-Term Mortgages, Financial Stability. Terrible marketing. It needs a new title. It's going to be a great conversation, but the title, here's my title. The Confidence Creed, the life-changing magic of longer-term mortgages. I know, so much better, right? And later, David Ashton is back to take our Moolala questionnaire. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The Canadian residential market is not equipped for longer-term mortgages. But according to Michael Feldman, there is a case to be made that a product like that would have a positive effect on the Canadian market. Michael is a corporate and commercial lawyer at Torrey's LLP. He is also the author of the CD Howe Institute's report, One More Case for Longer-Term Mortgages, Financial Stability. He joins us now to talk about the report. Hello there.
Hi, how are you?
I love the topic. I hate the title. I think it is the worst title I have ever heard for a report. Now, CD Howe is not known for their creative titles, but I've come up with a better one. Are you ready? Here it is.
Yes, please.
It's the new report is called The Confidence Creed, The Life-Changing Magic of Longer-Term Mortgages. What do you think?
I'll be honest, CD Howe picked the title, and I didn't care enough to want to debate it.
Well, I'll go directly to them to rebrand it, because it's a really important policy issue. It is a really important topic. So let's first dimensionalize what you mean when you say longer term. Is this the term of the mortgage, or is it the amortization?
It's the term, the legal maturity of the mortgage. So typically, Canadian mortgages do amortize over a long period of time, 25, 30, 35 years, but they mature generally, like 98% or more of the mortgages mature within 5 years. So when you get a quote from a bank, you get a quote from a one-year, two-year, three-year, four-year, five-year mortgage. You may find quotes for mortgages up to 10 years, but the interest rate on those mortgages would be much higher than the rate on a five-year mortgage. So there really isn't a market for mortgages greater than 5 years in Canada.
So if there were, what would be the benefits to the consumer? What would be the benefits to the banks? What would be the benefits to the government?
I'll do it in reverse order. From the government's point of view, it would provide more stability. The fact that mortgages renew so often mean that people have to get a renewal at least every 5 years. And if interest rates have gone up from the time that they set their mortgage, they may have a hard time refinancing that mortgage. If the real estate market has had a slump, then you've got, on average in any year, about 20% of the mortgage borrowers refinancing their mortgage or renewing their mortgage in a year when there's a real estate slump. And I think from a system stability point of view, it'd be better to stretch that out so that, you know, you have 15% or 10% a year instead of 20% a year. From the bank's point of view, there really is no incentive to offer longer term mortgages. Mm. And when I say banks, it's like all of the lenders, you know, some are banks, trust companies, and unregulated lenders. They're doing just fine with a 5-year mortgage. We've had a 5-year residential mortgage market for decades and decades, and we're all sort of the whole infrastructure with mortgage brokers and everybody is all geared up to people renewing their mortgages at least every 5 years. So who else other than financial stability could benefit from having longer term mortgages? I think the answer is the consumer could, because you'd be able to lock in your rate for a longer term. And, you know, you might say, well, people don't want longer terms in 5 years. It's interesting. Short-term rates are generally lower than, like, 1-year rates are generally lower than 5-year rates. But a good percentage of the market, like 40-50% of the market, opt for 5-year mortgages. They're willing to pay a reasonable premium to lock in for a longer term. If we could have a longer term, like a 10-year mortgage or even a 20-year, 25-year mortgage, 25-year mortgage that matched a 25-year amortization, I think there would be a pretty high number of consumers that would opt for that. But lenders don't really want to provide it. And that is because the way the law is in Canada is that there's a 5-year, there's a open prepayment option after 5 years.
Well, and I think that's a good segue to the disadvantages here, because let's take the case that someone 25 years ago signed up for a 25-year mortgage with a 25-year term and amortization. It would have been financially the worst move they ever could have made because interest rates have fallen to virtually nothing.
Right. And so that's why the government of Canada passed a statute about 140 years ago that said every mortgage, and they basically amended that to say every mortgage that an individual enters into, they carved out corporations, so you've got long-term commercial mortgages. But every mortgage that an individual enters into as borrower has to be open after 5 years. Mm. So if you did like 20 years ago, you had a 10% 25-year mortgage. After the first 5 years, if interest rates go down, you can open that mortgage and refinance it. So that's why lenders don't like to give 20-year mortgages, because they think they might be getting, you know, a high interest rate for 20 years, but it turns out that after 5 years, they get their mortgage repaid. Now, if you're a lender that tries to match their funding, you know, try to match their liabilities with their assets, if you have a 10-year asset, you like to have a 10-year liability so that you're earning a spread. If you've locked in a 10-year liability, like you've issued bonds for 10 years to fund your 10-year mortgage book, if the borrowers start prepaying because interest rates have gone down, then the bank gets whipsawed. They still have their 10-year debt outstanding. They don't have a prepayment option on their debt, but the borrower has but the mortgagor has a prepayment option on their debt.
What is the experience in other markets around the world? Is there a country that does this and has success behind it, or would we be leading the way?
Yeah, so far as I know, I mean, there's a lot of countries in the world, but Canada is unique. No other country that I'm aware of has all their residential mortgages come open after 5 years. Most countries, and particularly the United States, which is our closest neighbor, and they will have mortgage terms that match the amortization term. So if they have a 30-year amortization, they have a 30-year maturity. Hmm. However, they also have prepayment rights. And so as a result, mortgage rates tend to be higher in the United States than they are in Canada, because the lenders socialize that prepayment risk among all borrowers.
Right.
So you could get a 30-year mortgage in the U.S., but you may, after a period of time, and I'm not sure what the law is. It could be different in different states. You may want to refinance your mortgage at a lower rate if interest rates have gone down.
Interesting.
And that's exactly what does happen. If interest rates are going down, they refinance their mortgages at lower rates with other lenders. If interest rates are going up, they stick with their long-term mortgage.
Well, we will watch this. I think certainly this is a relevant topic to most every Canadian, though it'll be the policy wonks who will follow through and see how this thing unfolds. Michael, thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
Bruce, my pleasure. Take care.
Michael Feldman, corporate and commercial lawyer at Torrey's LLP. He authored a report for the C.D. Howe Institute called One More Case for Longer-Term Mortgages. I have rebranded it The Confidence Creed, the life-changing magic of longer-term mortgages. It's pretty good. Stay with us. Coming up later on the program, we'll take David Ashton through the Moolala questionnaire. But first, monetizing soft skills. Ann Taylor, founder of Directions Coaching, is here to talk about her book, Soft Skills, Hard Results, a practical guide for to people skills for analytical leaders. Now, if you want to hear me talk about some personal finance some more, I sure do. I am the money columnist for CBC Radio. So every single Wednesday afternoon, I am in your hometown with your local radio host. So tune in. If you have any comments or questions on the show, ask@moolala.ca is our email address. ask@moolala.ca. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Personal finance is an all-encompassing term. It is spending, it is saving, it is debt, it's investing, it's insurance, and it's income. And we don't talk all that much about how much people earn or how to earn more, but it's certainly an important variable in the overall equation here. So today, in a bit of a twist, we're going to talk about monetizing soft skills. How's that for a mouthful? Ann Taylor is the founder of Directors Coaching. She joins us now to talk about her latest book, her new book called Soft Skills, Hard Results, a practical guide to people skills for analytical leaders. She joins us from London, England. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
What do you mean by soft skills? I think I know what you mean, but what do you actually mean?
Soft skills are the people skills that you use when you're interacting in everyday life, whether it's at work or home. It's how you interact with people that matters in getting your results.
We talk a lot about the war for talent and we talk a lot about the innovation economy. What are the, I don't know, two or three most important soft skills that are most relevant in the marketplace today?
The first I would say is listening.
What did you just say? Sorry, I was on my phone. What?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Listening. It's actually hearing what people are saying, so that you understand where they're coming from rather than hearing what they say, what they're saying, so you can respond. The other big thing is knowing yourself well, knowing what you're bringing to every interaction. If you always are happy and upbeat, you might not realize that someone you're talking to is going through a down period in their life or might be suffering grief. So it's knowing some of your preferences and tendencies that you're bringing to that discussion.
You believe that the better one is at these soft skills, the more money that they may make. And that really, I mean, I know that's not the reason you wrote the book, but given that this is a show about money, that's kind of our vested interest. Why do you hold that belief?
Well, it's interesting because it is actually about making money. I wrote this book for my coaching clients who sometimes are so task-driven that they forget about the human element, the interaction part. And when they do the interaction part well with their staff, with their colleagues, with their bosses, they actually have a chance of making more money.
Mm.
They get more out of their teams. They're more productive. They have a chance of differentiating themselves and getting a promotion versus a colleague or a peer.
You outline a process in this book which begins with data, both existing data and harvesting new data as it relates to you, the individual. How do you go about finding that data? Is it like an MRI, a brain scan, an X-ray, Google Analytics? Do you have someone follow you around with a tape recorder? How do you get that data?
It's there every day. So if you're someone that works in an organization, you probably have done a performance review. So there's a bunch of data already. Mm-hmm. You can also look at any assessments you've done. So if you're a professional, often they'll take you on leadership courses. So you would have done assessments. There's also stuff that your friends and family tell you. Bruce, you're really efficient. You're always well organized. That's a piece of data about yourself that you are bringing to every interaction. So it's everywhere you look if you start just being more self-aware. Another neat thing I do say in the book is one that was shared with me by a fellow named Jack Wood, and it's the personal illustrative narrative. It's writing your life story and looking at what are the patterns and thoughts behind your life story, and that's data as well.
You also write about adapting authentically. What does that mean?
When I work with clients, they're always like, I don't want to be someone else. I don't want to put on a mask, which is great. I don't want people to either. That's tiresome. So how do you recognize that there's someone else across the desk from you that has all of their own stuff going on? You have all of your own stuff going on. How do you relate to them well, still being true to yourself? An example of that is if you're kind of a very humorous, fun-loving type of person.
Well, as a matter of fact, I am.
Ah, you are. That's where I got the example.
Yes, uh-huh.
If you know that about yourself, and you know someone else might not be that same disposition, how do you kind of temper it maybe if you're having a conversation with them about something important? Or maybe you decide to play it up in hopes of making it a lighter conversation for them. It's about using the elements of yourself a bit more skillfully.
When push comes to shove, are there times in which you just need to adapt, even if it's not authentic? I had a manager once who knew I was a sponge for feedback, and there was no way she was interested in doing this or even really saw what was in her vested interest to do it. But she did it, and you could see her grit her teeth, and, you know, she did it. And I could see what was so great for me was I gave her 1,000 karma points for making an effort in an area that was so foreign to her.
That's an amazing example of someone that responded to one of their staff needs. And even though it wasn't kind of authentic, it wasn't her usual thing, at least she tried it, and it had a massive impact on it. You still remember it to this day and appreciate her for it. Most leaders would love that.
Yeah. When it comes to working on working on soft skills, what do people need to be realistic about? How do you tell what is influenceable, what is coachable, what is trainable, and what just isn't? Do you start that from the belief that everyone and everything is coachable, or this is not your first rodeo, you've been coaching for a long time. Do you know in your experience that sometimes you simply can't crack that nut?
Sometimes you can't crack that nut. And it really depends on the individual. If they want to change bad enough, if they're motivated enough, you can crack a lot of nuts. And frankly, even if you don't crack the whole nut, if you can just make a little bit of a headway, sometimes that's enough for people. But it really comes down to the individual. Do they want to make the change? Why do they want to make the change? What's behind the way it is and behind how they want it to be? What are their beliefs? And then baby steps. Make a little step. It might not be the moon. At least you're hitting the stars, is the old expression.
One last question before we go here. For a lot of our listeners, for a lot of people on this planet, even talking about soft skills is terrifying. They still haven't got over that hurdle. They'd rather do a course on Excel macros or whatever. What is one piece of advice that you would offer for those who find themselves in that point? Like, they get it, logically it makes sense, and it is terrifying for them.
Yeah. Try something. And the easiest thing to try, you already alluded to it, is feedback. Acknowledge someone for something they've done. So say thank you for a job well done, and say one attribute or adjective that they did well in doing that job. You were really efficient. You were on time. You were within budget. Give them a behavior, a skill, or an attribute of themselves that they exhibited in doing that job.
It's very practical. I love how low the bar that you took, but for some people, that would be a stretch. That's great. And thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck with your book.
Thanks very much, Bruce.
Ann Taylor, founder of Directions Coaching. She is the author of Soft Skills, Hard Results, a practical guide to people skills for analytical leaders. And our reason for talking about this is we want you to have some more moo-la-la. Time now for the moo-la-la questionnaire. We have probably done, 110 of these, and I love every single one. They illuminate something about our guest. They illuminate something about money. They illuminate things about how we think about what's important in life. Our guest today, David Ashton, author of The Sleep Easy Guide, The Sleep Easy Retirement Guide, Answers to the 12 Biggest Financial Questions That Keep You Up at Night. Are you ready?
I am.
How would you describe your money personality?
Well, I'm very facts and figure oriented, but in day-to-day life, I'm much more of a wing it kind of person. So.
Really? Okay. So that's a kind of a, are you a, you aren't a wing it on, historically you wouldn't have been a wing it person on savings, were you?
Yes, but it's sort of, I think it's a different situation when you're on track to, and have a buffer in terms of achieving your goals. It's natural not to be so careful about all the details.
Now, you spent a lot of time in the corporate world. Did you have a pension? Were you contributing to a pension that you would have on exit?
No, some various savings plans, group RSPs.
But not a defined benefit
plan. But not a defined benefit plan.
Who was your money mentor growing up, would you say?
I think my parents instilled good sort of money values based on, you know, people that, you know, they grew up in the Depression and, you know, they're very frugal. So it set a nice standard in terms of being careful with your money. Now, I don't achieve their level of frugality or careful spending, but
you throw out Ziploc bags, don't you? I can tell.
Yes.
You do. Well, recycle,
yes.
I should say. You recycle them. They would ironed them and used them for decades.
That's right. So I don't live up to their standard, but still it's not, it's having that background makes me appreciate that a little bit more.
What is one of your guiltiest spending pleasures?
Travel, definitely.
Travel. Okay. Yes. What kind of travel? What travel do you love?
Going to different places, it's all, and this is obviously a baby boomer thing. Europe, we've been to Japan, we've been to
cycling
places.
In Provence. Yeah. Don't tell me you've been cycling in Provence.
No, it's more city vacations.
City vacations, What was your worst financial mistake? Did you get caught up in the dot-com bust like me?
No, probably the timing of buying our house at the end of the 1980s.
Oh, yes. I remember that well.
You know, it was one of those things where you're ready to buy a house and, you know, people can't really predict the future. And so it just as it happened, it was right before the, you know.
Fell off the cliff.
Yeah.
Now, did you hold on to that house?
We did.
You did. So in the fullness of time, you actually look like a rock star.
Well, it certainly things worked out in the fullness of time.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. So I love this question for you in particular. When do you plan to retire and what will you do?
I don't know. This is a nice thing about what I'm doing now as a freelance journalist. I can kind of control my schedule to a certain extent and work as much as I want. So it's something I enjoy. It's fulfilling. It's engaging. A little bit of money. So I'm kind of living one of the work styles that I talk about.
Sure. If you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large, what would it be?
One thing that makes sense is that in planning for retirement, it's a good idea for people to do that exercise, to plan for retirement. But I think of a lot of the anxiety that goes with it is maybe overdone.
Okay.
So
you snap your fingers.
So it's nice to relax a little bit. And certainly go through the exercise, do the planning, but be more open to finding a solution without getting so anxious about it.
David, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bruce.
David Ashton, author of The Sleep Easy Retirement Guide, Answers to the 12 Biggest Financial Questions That Keep You Up at Night. That is our show for today. Moo-la-la, Money Made Simple, is brought to you in part by EQ Bank, banking simplified. Now, don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca. And while you're at it, why not subscribe to our podcast version of this show too? Love it. I'm on social media in a couple of places. Bruce Ellery, Moolala is Facebook. At Bruce Ellery is Twitter. You can also go to our website and find tons of material from past episodes of this show, from CBC, from CityLine, from Yahoo Finance, all that stuff. Thank you for joining us, and have a great day.